Take cover. It's time for Weather Brains.
This time on Weather Brains.
We want to see that level of funding restored.
More from the director of the National Hurricane Center about funding, and more about proposed name changes for both the Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service. Plus, we'll hear from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The National Hurricane Center will continue to be the National Hurricane Center, and the National Weather Service will continue to be the National Weather Service.
Also this time, a Weather Brains Extra goes R. What's coming with the next generation weather satellite?
You'll be able to get images every 5 minutes routinely over the continent of the United States.
You'll hear what's planned from NOAA satellite meteorologist Tim Schmidt. Also this time, James Spann's global warming speech that turned a bit hostile.
These people just are mad.
Plus, Professor Peters looks at evaporative cooling. And on This Week in Weather History, Bill Murray recalls one of the greatest disasters in American history. And J.B. Elliott ponders the question, what should a weatherman look like?
We were supposed to be bald-headed, overweight, real thick eyeglasses.
Is that what they're supposed to look like? Find out coming up. It's episode number 70 of Weather Brains, the show that's all about weather, produced by The Weather Company. Hello, I'm David Black. Thank you for being with us. Also with us this ride, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, Brian Peters, and Bill Murray. James, how goes it?
Well, I guess we can officially declare summertime here, David, since the Memorial Day weekend is now in the books. So bring it on.
Absolutely. We are recording this program, in fact, on a Memorial Day, a very special day across the U.S. of A. J.B. Elliott, a fine American with us on board. How are you?
I'm doing well. Other than the bluish smoke in the skies, I'm doing fine.
A lot of smoke from fires in Georgia and Florida moving across some of the southeastern states. Been a real issue for folks. Brian Peters, what's in your world? What's happening?
Well, I just hated seeing 90-degree temperatures across the southeast yesterday because, as James noted, I guess that means even though summer doesn't officially start for another 23 or 24 days, that means summer must be here if you get into the 90-degree readings.
Yeah, it is for some folks. Bill Murray, are you on the road or are you at home this time? Where are you?
Actually, today has been stripping and getting ready to stain the deck tomorrow, David. It's been a home improvement kind of Memorial Day.
Are you a Tim Taylor kind of guy, or are you a real go-at-it-get-it-done right?
Nah, you know, I like going to Home Depot, and I end up coming back with way more stuff than I really probably need. But tonight I've got my son to at least help me, so I had a helper today.
Fair enough. We were talking about the warm weather, Mr. Peters was. I was just sitting here thinking, while folks in the eastern and southeastern U.S. are wishing, praying for a drop of rain that they're generally not getting, folks in the central U.S., the plain states, Texas, up into parts of Oklahoma, Kansas, really getting drenched. Heavy rains pounded central Oklahoma over the weekend. Rivers and creeks were swollen, sent over their banks. Hundreds of campers who showed up for the holiday weekend were stranded at a park in Oklahoma. About 1,500 campers at Turner Falls Park, that's near Davis, were stuck with their vehicles after flash flooding forced the closure of the only road leading into the campgrounds. Fortunately, nobody hurt in that. But that just gives you an idea of while some folks are high and dry, some other folks are really having to deal with too much rain. James, what are the, let me put you on the spot and get a real quick national forecast. Who's in for wet weather? Who's in for more drought? Any idea on that?
By the way, David, we understand that Kevin Selly was seen floating in a raft down the Trinity River south of Dallas in one of those swollen creeks, so that's the reason he's not here tonight. I don't know if the pole pattern changes all that much. You know, as you get into summer, the main westerlies kind of park up there near the Canadian border, and things get kind of bland across the deep south. I do think that the weather's going to be heating up over Texas and the southwest U.S. We're forecasting Phoenix to be between 100 and 105 most every day this week. And even in the Rio Grande of Texas, we're talking mid to upper 90s, maybe triple digits in spots. So weather looking hotter and probably a tad drier for the central United States. And something about the tropics, it just looks nervous down there. Unsettled, nervous is JB's word, but I wouldn't be shocked if some early season system were to get its act together in the southeastern Gulf or the Atlantic and hopefully wetting down the Florida Peninsula at some point, because they need rain like everybody else here in the southeast U.S.
Well, speaking of the tropics, last week on Weather Brains Episode 69, we heard concerns by the National Hurricane Center's director, Bill Proenza, over how NOAA, the Hurricane Center's parent agency, is spending our tax dollars. But Proenza's being vocal on some other issues as well, and we have more of our interview with him this episode. He's pushing to reverse what he says is a $700,000 budget shortfall the Hurricane Center faces. And he's lobbying against what's said to be a plan by NOAA to change the names of both the National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service, the new names being the NOAA Hurricane Center and the NOAA Weather Service. Now, we also asked Mr. Proenza for his thoughts on the just-announced departures of two top Weather Service officials, David Johnson, director of the Weather Service, and John Jones, the National Weather Service's deputy director. NOAA, as I understand it, has cut about $700,000 from NHC's budget. What does that do to your efforts as head of NHC?
More accurately, let me just define the money that has been cut. There is a particular program under the National Hurricane Center called the Joint Hurricane Testbed. It involves short 1 to 2 year projects that are proposed to us that carry the science and the technology that's out there to some sort of infusion into our operations. That is, it brings that latest bit of development in science and technology into the operational activities of the National Hurricane Center. So it kind of brings in the benefits of what's out there into our operations. And that's important to us in the model developments and fine-tuning of the models and any other operational aspect of what we draw on for data and for models in being able to forecast the atmosphere into the future. And it is important for us to continue to have that level of funding. What has happened is that in fiscal year, this current operational year, we were shortchanged somewhat over $200,000, and back in fiscal year 05, we were shortchanged another $300,000 for a total of $500,000.
I think it's a fair question, Mr. Proenza, that the American people, your customers, might have some concerns given predictions of an active Atlantic season this year of how well you can do your job if you're getting your money trimmed.
Yes, and we want to see that level of funding restored. And I have made that plea to through my chain of command up into NOAA, and I'm hoping that we will be able to turn that around for the upcoming year. A total of $500,000 that have been cut and another $200,000 in overhead and support for travel and training and so forth at the National Hurricane Center, it gives us a shortfall of $700,000 that we have talked about.
The departures of David Johnson, director, and John Jones, deputy director, both on June 30th. Coincidence with all this?
I believe that those may be associated with other issues involving their personal careers and what they wanted to do, because in reality, I believe those were scheduled before the current, how should I say, controversy associated with the funding and the name recognition and other issues that have come to the forefront in public awareness involving the National Hurricane Center, a part of the National Weather Service. So I do not think that they're directly related.
You're on the forefront of this issue with NOAA, of course, and the name change. What's next? Are you going to have continuing discussions with upper management?
I will. I will do everything I can to make sure that I am responsible to the mission that I'm charged to make sure that we can deliver for the American people. We are a nation that is definitely vulnerable as far as hurricanes and tropical storms. Furthermore, we're a nation that is vulnerable if you look at the entire global severe weather output of the world, that we represent some of the world's most active severe weather areas. And with that in mind, I think it is imperative that all of those factors be weighed in to making sure that we can be as effective as possible in delivering our mission to the protection of life. There can be nothing more important than that.
That's Bill Proenza, director of the National Hurricane Center. But NOAA officials counter Mr. Proenza's comments, saying the NHC has not had its budget cut. And they say not everything we're hearing about the rebranding proposal is correct either. NOAA spokesman Anson Franklin tells our Kevin Selly about what the agency wants to do and why.
The National Weather Service and the National Hurricane Center becoming the NOAA centers, is that correct?
That is not correct. I think that was a gleam in somebody's eye at one point. This idea has been around for about 10 years about increasing NOAA's identity or connecting it in some fashion to the Weather Service. There is no current proposal, and the best I can determine, there has not been a proposal, an active proposal, to change the names of the Hurricane Center or the National Weather Service. The National Hurricane Center will continue to be the National Hurricane Center, and the National Weather Service will continue to be the National Weather Service. Now, what we are talking about as far as a branding campaign is to get a more widespread use of the NOAA logo to help, you know, essentially a shared identity. This is not to replace anything the Weather Service has, but it would just be to include the use of the logo. And I think you've seen that in some places around the country. The other thing that we have been doing or encouraging for about 5 years is that NOAA be appended to a name. And so you will see in a lot of cases references to NOAA's National Weather Service, NOAA's National Ocean Service, and so forth. But there is an effort on NOAA's part to increase the name recognition because we believe it helps us present to the people the wide variety of services that we offer.
I would agree. It's interesting to me, and we've been talking about it on our program a little bit, the NOAA brand, especially when you just hear it, can create some confusion. I know one of our folks had said, you know, he gets a call. He's a big weather radio fan and promotes that a lot. He's a television meteorologist as well. And he says he gets a lot of calls from people asking how to go and buy a NOAA weather radio. And to them, the NOAA is the brand name, like Midland or somebody else.
Well, as you know, that's not the case. NOAA is the name of the radio, and that is a form of branding. But there are numerous companies that manufacture the radio. Not all of them have the name NOAA Weather Radio because there are certain specifications that go with attaching that name to it.
And do you folks sense that there's a confusion with regard to that name or what it means from people? I know some folks have said even they get calls from people, you know, somehow trying to associate it with NOAA and the flood.
Well, I guess I can understand that under certain circumstances. Part of the idea is that when people hear NOAA, they know what it is. I mean, this is something that takes time. And I will tell you, having come from another relatively obscure agency with a budget that is twice the size of NOAA's, that I've come to a place that has much better name recognition around the country and here in Washington. But, you know, NASA started out as the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and now everybody refers to it as NASA, and it's taken many years and a lot of attention to get to that point. But when you see things in print, such as in Space News, when they start out with NASA and the, you know, National and NOAA, but they say National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, you know that we're not quite there yet. And that's just one of the things that we're trying to achieve.
Sure. And I suppose some folks still remember the U.S. Weather Bureau from many, many years ago.
I've heard about that.
So to wrap that up then, to sum that up, National Weather Service as a brand name, not going away. National Hurricane Center, not going away. But in some areas, we would see them branded with the NOAA name or logo in association with those.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, in the Miami Herald, there was some discussion of the departures and retirements of David Johnson and John Jones. And the Miami Herald was trying to tie that to the comments made by Bill Proenza. Can you comment on that?
They're completely unrelated.
Okay. Because those were planned prior to those comments, I assume.
Well, that's right. John, nothing moves that quickly in the government, for one thing. John Jones has been here for 33 years, and he had decided to retire. General Johnson had decided to move on to do other things, but these were you know, decisions that they made long before the Bill Proenza flap started.
And then to stay with that for just a moment, he had made some comments, Mr. Proenza, about some budgetary concerns with regard to the NOAA 200 celebration and some money that I guess maybe was supposed to have gone to some hurricane research. Can you clarify that?
I want to make several points addressing basically news reports about all of this. There have been no cuts to hurricane research or forecasting budgets. There have been no cuts to the National Hurricane Center budget. We have had growth in all of those budgets. Last year, we moved $57 million from other NOAA programs into the Weather Service budget. So the money is flowing in the opposite direction. We do have an education and outreach program, which is called NOAA's 200, that helps us take our message to the people again about the services that we offer and you know, the many things that we offer to people that they need, whether it's a technology that helps scientists or a NOAA weather radio or other safety and preparedness information. It's a separate program here. None of the money for it came from the Weather Service, and we're spending $750,000 a year over 2 years, so that's nowhere near the $4 million figure that I've seen bandied about. And finally, Admiral Lautenbacher, the administrator of NOAA, was asked about this just a couple days ago, and he pointed out that we spend about $10 million a year on outreach efforts. It's a responsibility of every government agency to have this kind of activity, and he wishes we could put more to it, but none of it has come from the Weather Service.
That's Anson Franklin, a spokesman for NOAA. Now, on one of our previous Weather Brains episodes, you heard comments about a prototype website NOAA had launched to show some of its rebranding intentions. We've posted a link to that site if you'd like to see it now. It's at our website, weatherbrains.com. Time for the Weather Roundtable now, where everybody talks about what is on their mind, whether it's NOAA technology, weather, whatever. Mr. Spann, you want to give it a go round?
I thought I'd share my story about my global warming heckler.
Okay.
I still don't know why all of a sudden I was cast into the spotlight as the, anti-global warming guy, but I was invited to give a talk at a local library about the issue. And I appreciate that because they showed Al Gore's movie, and they came in and gave me the opportunity to share my side of the story, which is the way it ought to be. And I came in and had a little presentation, and I noted one guy. There's always one. It was a nice crowd, and mostly older people. This was during the middle of the day when most folks were at work, and noticed one guy. He was the guy that stood out, and he was taking notes, and you could just tell the guy was mad, and the veins were coming out on his neck. And when it was over, and he made a point for me. What I told those people, typically when people are critical of those of us with my point of view, they will insult us and not get into the scientific argument, and that's exactly what he did. He insulted me and where I'm from and my education and all of that.
So it got personal.
Yeah, and he didn't say anything about, the 40-minute talk I just gave, all these facts and figures that, quite frankly, I don't know anybody could argue this stuff because it's all true. And after that, it got a little heated with some of the older gentlemen, didn't like him picking on me like that, and got a little out of hand. But I just find it interesting that nobody wants to debate me on the merits of the issue. They just want to insult me. So I thought that was strange. So I tried to get that off my chest.
Nobody wants to argue with you on the basis of science.
Yeah. And, this guy insulted me because I went to, Mississippi State University. where he said Heidi Cullen is enlightened because she went to, you know, some Ivy League school or something. And but he never, not once, made any reference to any of the information I shared. He also read the American Meteorological Policy Statement on Climate Change, which is in total, I'm in total disagreement with. And with the AMS, you don't have to agree with their policy statements, if you remember. And I've shared that with him. But anyway, these people just are mad, and they're livid, and I don't understand why there's such passion. I know it's a lot of money floating around out there, but he was my global warming heckler of the week.
Well, the beauty of this country is everybody can have an opinion. Bill Murray, yep, what's... Go ahead.
That's what I told him. I said, sir, you're welcome to your opinion. I'm glad you're here. So,
well, the same thing happened to me, James, at a Rotary meeting about an unrelated topic that I was talking about, but they knew I loved the weather, and they got me off on global warming. And this guy just came up at the end of the meeting and just chewed me up one side down the other, and I tried to discuss it in terms of facts. I said, look, here's the research, show me your research. I'm showing my work, you show yours. And it was nothing but a personal attack. So
it's probably the same guy.
Probably was.
Yeah, right. All right, Bill, what's on your mind?
Well, I tell you, what's on my mind tonight, David, are these seasonal forecasts that are issued by the Hurricane Center and by Dr. Gray and other people out there in the world. When I was in high school, my best friend and I were both interested in the weather, and just the other night I was looking through some old materials that I had around the house, and every year when we were in high school, if this doesn't qualify me as a weather nerd, I don't know what will, we would make a forecast. This was back 1977, 78, 79. We made our own season and predictions, and we actually were quite good. It's kind of scary because we made specific predictions not only on how many storms there would be, but where they would form, how strong they would be, where they would make landfall. And a lot of that was based on climatology because obviously we didn't have access to research information. So we, I went back and looked at these things, and they really were not worth the paper they were printed on. And I'm beginning to wonder whether our seasonal forecasts are any more valuable today. I know they're based on a lot more research, climatology, technology, data, all those sorts of things, but I really think that the criticism of the 2006 seasonal forecast cast a lot of unnecessary aspersions on the job that the Hurricane Center did, because a lot of people read those things and take them for gospel. So I'm not sure that after the performance of the last two seasons, we should not issue those to the public. I think they've done more damage than good, even though they're there to increase awareness of the hurricane problem. But, I really have heard nothing but derision about even the latest forecast from NOAA, which says we'll have 13 to 17 storms and a 75% chance that the season's going to be above normal. I've seen some people actually picking that apart. So maybe they should even be like the fire weather forecasts that are only issued to governmental agencies and behind the scenes and not the general public.
What you're talking about almost makes me think about how some people react to the Hurricane Center's map predictions of where a hurricane will strike when they'll do the landfall maps, and you see the big cone with the line down the middle, and people judge it based off the line and tend to kind of disregard the margin on either side.
Yeah, you've really got to understand the basis of how that's issued and the reasoning behind it.
Yeah, and the thinking is, well, if it wasn't on the line, then it's wrong, and that's not what they're saying. But they don't.
Yeah, nowhere else was that more evident than Punta Gorda back in 2004 with Hurricane Charley, because people in that Charlotte Harbor area just thought they were safe because the black line led 50 miles to the north over Tampa.
Fair enough. J.B. Elliott, what you know?
David, as you well know, I was in the Weather Service for 32 years, and the last 10 years or so that I was in the National Weather Service, our forecast center was in a six-story office building, and on Sundays, we were the only ones in the building. So one Sunday afternoon, as I was going off duty at 4 o'clock, I noticed a small boy, about 5 or 6 years old, with his face pressed against the plate glass door, entrance to our office. A man was standing behind him. I opened the door and asked if I could help them. The man explained that his son was extremely interested in weather and listened to the weather radio every day. He begged his dad to bring him to our place so he could see what a weather office looked like. He especially wanted to see where the radio station was that did the radio broadcast on weather radio. But I was off duty, but I didn't mind. I invited them into the office and spent 45 minutes giving them a tour of the office, explaining everything. Even gave the little boy some weather maps, satellite photos, and weather brochures like we used to give to Bill Murray when he hung around on weekends. Even let him tape a brief weather item that went out on the weather radio, and that really thrilled him. By the way, he thought NOAA was a station call letters, N-O-A-H, radio, like KMOX, WMAQ, and WBAP, you name it. Anyway, as we walked out the door together, he gave me a big hug to thank me. Then he said, "But you don't look like a weatherman." That spiked my interest, of course, so I asked him what did he think a weatherman looked like. He gave me a long, rambling answer, and the way I pieced it together, we were supposed to be bald-headed, overweight, real thick eyeglasses, wearing one of those green shaded caps that newspaper people wore in Western movies, and like some of the people on the cover of Mad Magazine. In fact, he mentioned Mad Magazine. He finally said, "I did not think they looked like you."
I love it. Well, you know, Span fits that to a degree. He fits one of those parameters anyway, but not all of them.
Yep.
That's a great story. See, I was expecting you to tell me who that person came up to be, you know, some big weather person.
I lost his name. I wish I knew where he was now, because he would be about 25 or 28 years old.
That's a neat story. Well, you probably really inspired somebody.
I hope so. At a
young age. That's a great one.
Of course, they have the advantage now of watching TV meteorologists like James, and they know what they look like. But back then, I'm sure a lot of people wondered if we were weird looking.
Well, we've heard from some folks who've sent us some nice emails lately. We wanted to say thanks to Scott Udell for contacting us. Also, Jim Walker contacted us from Birmingham, Alabama. And we heard from Nate Gotts, who writes, "On one of your previous shows, someone said that some television stations don't even have a Doppler radar, yet they say that they have the most powerful Doppler radar in a 100-mile area. Is there any way to find out which stations don't have one? Also, why do they say they have one when they don't? You would think that they would rather say, according to the National Weather Service, than say that they have a Doppler radar when in reality they don't." Anybody want to tackle that
one? I'm the guy that started that, and you know, part of the problem, David, and you've been there, a lot of the television promotion departments are totally disconnected with the weather people, and I'm not blaming the weather people, but I think that TV promotion folks, the ones that write the spots and produce the spots, ought to be a little better learned about the concept of radar. And I'm telling you, there are stations all over this country that will promote their super duper Doppler Wappler 1,000,000 radar, where all they've got is a piece of software that is taking data from the Weather Service NEXRAD sites and displaying them on the air, and they call it their own. And you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the reason they're there. Those NEXRAD systems are there for us to use. But to me, if you say that's your own radar, then that's misleading and just almost a downright lie. So I just think that we have to be really careful. And there's probably a way, David, to search the FCC database to see who's got a license to run a radar in some markets and who don't. You know, that would be interesting. Maybe somebody ought to post one of those websites with all that on there or something.
I guess it's a good thing that television station promotion departments don't have to go too much with any truth in advertising laws. That's what it sounds like to me.
Man, let me tell you what. Yep, they'd be in big trouble. And yeah, it's just aggravating, you know. But maybe one day somebody will put up one of those websites who really describes who has an operational radar in certain markets. That would be really interesting.
Absolutely. Well, we've talked about radar being one of these high-tech items in forecasting. One of NOAA's big budget items also is the weather satellite. And right now, government scientists are planning GOES-R. That's the next generation weather satellite. It promises to carry aloft newer and more advanced technology. And that means information in finer detail and more of it. GOES-R will have some new capabilities, including geostationary lightning mapping. But there are some capabilities the satellite won't have, and that has raised controversy within the scientific community. We've got a Weather Brains Extra for you, GOES-R. Tim Schmidt is a NOAA satellite meteorologist. He's assigned to the University of Wisconsin's Space Science and Engineering Center. A lot of folks hear the term next generation GOES. What exactly does that mean? What does that encompass?
We build satellites in blocks, if you will. So, for example, and as you know, they get letters when they're on the ground. But anyways, we basically had the GOES 8 series, which is up there, right? GOES 8 series. And then the GOES NOP series, which we've launched one of them. Then GOES N became GOES 13 when it was launched and checked out last year. But anyways, it's a little bit confusing. There's basically been three generations. There's the kind of programmatically, they split up between GOES 8 and GOES P, because there's actually the same instruments on two different spacecraft bus. In fact, I can point you to a document from NASA, and it talks about the next generation. Well, they're talking about a next generation, which is in this intermediate step, if you will, GOES NOP, not what I will say is the next generation, which is GOES R. So when I talk about the next generation, I'm talking about GOES R.
Tell me a little bit more about R. What's involved in getting it actually deployed? When is it likely to happen at this point? What is its progress report to this point?
GOES R continues the operational, you know, requirements that happens right now. As you know, there are a large number of uses of the current GOES imagers and sounders to better depict moisture in the atmosphere, clouds, skin temperature, fires, winds, hurricanes, severe storms, precipitation, etc. So GOES R continues all those continuity issues. And again, I'm really focusing on the meteorological aspect now. GOES R has an advanced baseline imager, ABI, which we move from a five-channel spectral channels, different filters, if you will, which is on the current GOES imager, to a 16-channel imager on ABI. So basically a factor of 3 in spectral improvement. The ABI will also be able to scan much faster, meaning, you know, cover more things on the Earth, basically a factor of 5 there. And it also has finer resolution or smaller pixel size to be able to depict smaller phenomena.
What other technology will be aboard?
There are other instruments. For example, there'll be the first ever geostationary lightning mapping capability on GOES R. So, for example, then you can start to use this information together. So the lightning mapper can tell you, for example, where the convection is. The imager can tell you, for example, you know, where the clouds are and where they're moving to and what heights they're at, etc.
So what does this mean for people who will be using the data?
Similar to today, again, the data can be used to better observe the atmosphere right now, and can be used in a short-term or the now-casting sense. Can also be used, for example, to put this information into numerical models to better forecast. So, for example, you can use looking at the time sequence of these images to, as we do today, to derive motion vectors of the atmosphere and put that into numerical models. It's shown that, for example, they improve hurricane forecasts. That's what today's GOES. With the future GOES, GOES R, the data will be improved, the information will be improved to get improved yet, for example, improved hurricane forecasts.
So in a very broad sense, you're getting finer detailed data and you're getting more of it from the next generation.
Correct. I mentioned the additional spectral bands that allow some new products to be done or improving over what we do today. For example, you know, today the current imager cannot see upper level SO2, which may be of interest because that is sometimes a byproduct of a volcanic explosion. And of course, in that can be embedded as in volcanic ash. And again, the spectral bands on ABI can then pick that up or pick up some of these volcanic ash times for use in aviation. Of course, the lightning mapper was also very used for aviation interests for knowing where the strong updrafts are, for example, within the clouds.
It seems like different systems are contemplated and planned at one time or another for these satellites, and then they get pulled off the drawing board, so to speak. Why is that? Is this technical considerations, or does it boil down to money, or both?
Well, there are choices that have to be made of basically what you want, with what you can afford. Those decisions have to be made. But, you know, I mean, I don't think it's any secret that you know, while these instruments can do a lot, they also can cost a lot, too.
I've heard about equipment that is referred to as sounding and coastal imaging instrumentation, that's been pulled. And if I understand correctly, that is not going to be part of the next generation. Is that a loss to the forecasting community?
It is not a gain to the forecasting community.
Why? What are we not going to get that we would have potentially gotten?
Well, I mean, I'm not a oceanographer, so I won't really talk to the coastal waters applications. Again, this was a two-part suite. The sounding was to be a high spectral to give more vertical information of the atmosphere. That decision was made not to be on GOES-R, the early part of the series. NOAA is still looking at seeing if it can get on maybe the later part of the series, for example, GOES-T.
Of all the new systems that are going up, what piques your curiosity or excites you the most as a meteorologist for its potential value? Anything stand out?
On GOES-R, you know, both the first ever geostationary lightning capability, I think we're going to find a lot of uses for that. Again, these advanced capabilities with imager, being able to, right now, you get images, say, over CONUS, continental United States, every 15 minutes. Well, with the ABI on GOES-R, you'll be able to get images every 5 minutes routinely over the continental United States. And the select regions, there's called a mesoscale mode, where you can zoom in, if you will, and take more rapid imaging of certain fastly changing phenomena. So again, with today's imagers, we kind of have to choose. Do we want to look at the global scale, which we take a full disk every 3 hours, or the kind of the regional scale, or at some point give that up and go on to these really small scales in a super rapid scan operations, where with ABI, we really don't have to make those choices because it'll scan faster, that we can basically remove that conflict.
This sounds like it could be really huge for trying to stay on top of developing severe weather systems,
yeah,
for example?
Exactly, yep. So basically the improved temporal resolution, and then of course just the new spectral bands gives us a choice to improve, or even some new products as well.
So if the people at SPC want to track a line of severe storms sweeping across the Gulf Coast, what does this mean they'll be able to do?
As you know, they use a combination of satellite and radar, and this will much improve their satellite component of those storms. But more importantly, there's been some research, for example, that, of course, the radar doesn't pick up until there is the echo from precipitation. For example, can we use these data from the satellites? And there, again, has been research to support this, where you can start to take data and, in a sense, predict where there are going to be radar echoes, say, 20 minutes later. So, again, to try to move things forward or in time to see what's not just happening right now, but what's going to happen.
When is this likely to go up at this point?
The plans right now are launch readiness December 2014. There's a lot of steps. You know, it's all the design, fabrication, testing to get the instrument, and then the integration into the satellite, testing, launch, checkouts, et cetera.
That's Tim Schmidt, a NOAA satellite meteorologist. He's at the University of Wisconsin's Space Science and Engineering Center. The issue of the sounding and coastal imaging instrumentation is something some of the scientists I've talked with are hoping very anxiously will be restored to some future generation of GOES, maybe a GOES-T, as Tim mentioned. I don't suppose that stuff is cheap either.
Nope. And where would we be without satellite technology?
Don't even want to think about that.
I can't help but think about my own career and how when we first got those polar orbiting satellites and we had one image every 12 hours, and that was so wonderful. And he's talking about a new image, high-resolution image, every 5 minutes. Isn't that amazing?
I assume the lightning collection in that will be up to the minute, real time?
I wish I knew the answer to that, but it sure sounds like it's going to be pretty impressive or more current than what we get now.
Yeah, that sounds exciting.
Of course, we have a few more years to wait until that system gets launched, but it's getting better all the time. More information, and it sounds like much more detailed information as well. We'll follow the next generation GOES as time goes on, too. I'm sure that there will be more news and developments about what is coming ahead to be heading up into space above us. All right, gang, get your books out. It's WeatherBrains 101 class time again as Brian Peters, a.k.a. Professor Peters, tackles evaporative cooling.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
There are all sorts of processes going on in the atmosphere. One of the things that makes it interesting. Evaporation and condensation are two important but opposite processes. Evaporation is a physical phenomenon in which a liquid or solid is transformed to a gaseous state. Condensation, on the other hand, is the process by which a gas becomes a liquid or solid. In meteorology, evaporation is restricted to the change of water from liquid to gas, while the term sublimation is used to describe the change from solid to gas, as well as from gas to solid. Evaporation is a cooling process, so we often hear those words used together, evaporative cooling. When considering water evaporating into air, the wet bulb temperature, as compared to the air's dry bulb temperature, is a measure of the potential for evaporative cooling. The greater the difference between the two temperatures, the greater the evaporative cooling effect. When the temperatures are the same, no net evaporation of water to air occurs. Thus, there is no cooling effect. Probably one of the simplest examples of evaporative cooling is that little shiver you may feel even on a warm day when you step out of the shower. The evaporation of the water from your skin cools you down. Evaporative cooling can play a big role in the atmosphere in severe storms and in winter weather situations. As a downdraft of precipitation falls toward the surface, dry air mixes into the saturated air, causing cooling to occur due to evaporative cooling. This makes the downdraft colder and denser and will accelerate the air toward the ground, resulting in a convective wind gust that may be damaging. In the winter, precipitation falling into a dry layer near the ground will help to lower air temperatures, and that could change the temperature profile to one supportive of snow, sleet, or freezing rain. That's WeatherBrains 101 for this edition. If you have questions about weather terms, send them to question@weatherbrains.com.
Thank you very much, Professor Peters. You know, I was thinking about that discussion J.B. Elliott had many years ago about what weather people look like. I wonder if Professor Peters looks like any of those people that he was talking about. The thick glasses and bald. I don't know.
Looks like Colonel Sanders.
Colonel Sanders. just something to think about.
I think I'm going to go for the Professor Colonel, or perhaps Colonel Professor.
Colonel Professor, the esteemed Colonel Professor Peters.
Esteemed. I like that.
Very well. All right, time to switch gears and look at some interesting history. An entire city that took only 2 hours to be completely flooded, and it was never rebuilt. It happened on this date in 1948. And this week marks the anniversary of one of the greatest disasters in American history. More from Bill Murray, who's got This Week in Weather History.
Let's take a look back at some interesting weather history for the week of May 29th through the June 4th. And it was on a personal note that back on May 29th, 2004, I headed to the Plains States for a day of storm chasing. High risk of severe weather was forecast by the Storm Prediction Center, but late in the day it looked like that forecast was going to be a bust. But a single long-lived supercell storm produced 9 tornadoes in southern Kansas and Harper and Sumner counties, and I had a front row seat. It was a very moving experience to see the power of nature at its most violent up close and personal. Fortunately, the tornadoes remained over rural areas, and there was light damage and no injuries. John Park Finley of the U.S. Army Signal Corps was the first bona fide tornado researcher. Back in 1879, he was assigned the task of researching tornadoes across the Plains States. One of the first ones he investigated was an F-4 that struck Kansas on this date, May 30, 1879. He set up a network of volunteer tornado reporters all across the tornado-prone areas of the Plains and the Midwest, devising a set of parameters for predicting when tornadoes were likely to occur. That's very similar to what we use today. But caught in a power struggle with his superiors, Finley's research was cast aside and he was reassigned. Tornado forecasting was set back nearly 60 years. Vanport City was a huge federal housing project built along the banks of the Columbia River north of Portland, Oregon during World War II. During the war, 40,000 shipbuilding workers lived there. That number dropped to about 19,000 after the war. The winter of 1947 and 48 produced heavy snowfall amounts in the upper Columbia River Basin, and warm temperatures that spring caused rapid melting of the snowpack, and rivers and streams quickly jumped their banks. There was little concern in Vanport City despite the rising water. A happen. On Sunday, May the 30th, 1948, a dike which supported a rail track on the west side of the development suddenly collapsed. The crevasse widened within minutes to over 500 feet wide, and it only took 2 hours to flood the entire city. 25 people drowned in the flood, which served for very little warning, of course. The residents of the town lost all their personal belongings, most escaping with just the clothes on their backs. 10,000 homes were destroyed. Now, Vanport City would never be rebuilt. The area is a flood mitigation zone now, with parks and golf courses. In 1951, on May 30th, a bean was found actually embedded in a chicken egg following the passage of a tornado at Scotts Bluff, Nebraska. The egg was not even cracked. On May 31st, 1889, one of our nation's greatest natural disasters occurred. 2 days of very heavy rains caused the shoddily constructed and poorly maintained dam at the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club above Johnstown, Pennsylvania, to collapse, sending a wall of water 75 feet high and 1/2 mile wide down the Little Cunnamah River. The entire lake emptied into the valley of the river in just 36 minutes, flowing with the force of Niagara Falls. Now, there were warnings during the day by telegraph that the dam might break, but most people in Johnstown believed that it couldn't fail. The huge wave of water and debris smashed into Johnstown at 4:07 p.m., destroying much of the town as well as neighboring communities. More than 2,200 people died in the disaster. May 31st is a bad day in Pennsylvania weather history. Not only did the first Johnstown flood occur on May 31st, but Pennsylvania's deadliest tornado outbreak killed 63 people on the last day of May in 1985. At least three of the tornadoes were rated as F3, seven rated F4, and one even rated as an F5. And finally, it was this week back in 1953 that the U.S. Weather Bureau began the practice of using female names to identify tropical storms and hurricanes in the North Atlantic, Caribbean, and Gulf of Mexico. David, that's this week in weather history.
Thank you very much, Mr. Murray. Well, we talked about the next generation weather satellite a minute ago, but next time on Weather Brains, we're going to look into what's being planned as far as the next generation weather radar. Bigger? More powerful than what's out there now? Nope. How about a smaller, less powerful network of radars, you could say, is low down?
It can actually respond to user needs very specifically, and it will be what I call as a data pull system.
We talk with a Colorado State University professor involved in what's called CASA, a radar project currently being tested at 3 sites in Oklahoma. This could one day mean a wireless network-style radar system atop a building near you. If you'd like to contact the Weather Geeks at Weather Brains, our email address is question@weatherbrains.com. Better yet, you might like to leave a voicemail for us if you'd care to. You may do so free of charge. We've got a toll-free number, 1-888-247-8777. That's 1-888-247-8627. For the Weather Brains crew, James Spann, J.B. Elliott, Brian Peters, Bill Murray, I'm David Black. We do thank you for listening and hope that you'll take a chance and listen to us again next time. Weather Brains is copyright 2007. All rights reserved. Adios. Enjoyed it, guys. What do y'all think of the show? Was it medium?
Enjoyed
enough?
It, all you weather freaks.
Yeah. Very nice. Very nice. Yes.
We kind of covered the gamut from radar and satellite to what weather people probably look like.
I think that's great. I want to see JB with one of those, you know, green little screens over his head. That would be great.
Yeah. I already fit the other descriptions.
A green screen over his head.
I don't know, JB. I think you're losing a lot of weight.
I've lost 46 pounds.
What's your secret, JB? How are you doing it?
I'm staying away from barbecue in that barbecue place down in Maplesville where James goes.
I think JB's getting too skinny. Somebody get that man a milkshake.
Yeah, don't you cheat every now and then, JB, and have like a slice of coconut pie or something?
You know, you've talked me into it. I'll do it.
There you go. He's going to get a milkshake and coconut pie right now.
He has great motivation, too. Judy was standing by the refrigerator with a gun.
Go ahead. Yep. Make my day. All right, gang. Enjoyed it.
All right. See you, guys. Boys. Bye-bye.
Good night.